Tonight we're going to be talking about the male and female role. And that's not the one that develops when you're about 40 around your waist. That has nothing to do with it whatsoever. The male and female role of their identity. And the subject tonight, the importance of it and the urgency of it cannot at all be overemphasized. There's a quotation, and I'm going to read some things tonight that I know will be of interest to you. A man by the name of John M. Batteau makes this statement: our society is going through a period of profound cultural unrest and open moral degeneration. And I know that we wouldn't take exception to that. The bill for homosexual rights introduced by Congressman Edward Koch, Democrat from New York, and the case of Larry Flint and Hustler magazine are just two examples. Sadomasochistic and other pornographic literature infests our city streets. The propaganda for a homosexual lifestyle is part of this moral unrest. Now, we're witnessing a moral and social upheaval, the likes and proportions of which I suspect few generations have ever witnessed. Now, I'm not saying that we're totally unique, but I am saying that we're a part of a moral and social upheaval in our culture that it's frightening, and our young people are having to bear the brunt of it. And we as parents and as adults before them must give them some clear signals if we're to help them through these formative years of their life. There are many movements underway today. Many of these movements are designed specifically to undermine our culture, to undermine our customs, our mores, our principles. Many of them are movements that have grown out of other movements, and sometimes the ones who are caught in it and the ones who are caught up in these movements are simply being used as dupes who don't recognize what the implications of the movement are. Now, one of these, I think, and I won't necessarily go into the details at all, the Equal Rights Amendment today is going under the guise of equal rights for women or for all people. But that's not really the end result of that amendment. The Equal Rights Amendment is an attempt to abolish all differences between men and women. And they would destroy many of the rights, this amendment would destroy many of the rights that our women have earned and that they rightfully deserve. But this amendment would destroy those and bring about a unisex society. The dress codes and the standards of dress that exist in the world, that have existed in our culture for 200 years in America alone, it's being wiped. We're seeing people dress more in what they call a unisex dress. And you can't really tell whether it's a man or a woman by the way sometimes people dress. Women are dressing more like men. There's a movement for men to dress more like women. And we all get caught in it. The hairstyles of the men at one time, 4 or 5 years ago, it was the trend and the style among a subculture to show their rebellion by the length of hair they wore. And you couldn't tell whether it was a man or a woman. And the women are likewise coming to the place many times where their hair is so short, you can't really tell whether the person is a man or a woman. Now, all of these are simply trends toward a unisex society. But you may want to ask, well, what difference does it make? Well, just this simple difference. Jesus states it in Matthew 19, where he said that God made them from the beginning male and female. He made us that way. We are that way physiologically. And because of what God made in us and designed in us, we are that way psychologically. We are that way emotionally. You're a man because God made you like that. and you're a woman because God made you like that. And aren't you glad, men, that women aren't men? Amen. I'm so glad there's a difference. And I hope and pray that we preserve that difference. Women are the nobler part of God's creation. You precious women, if it weren't for your sense of right, if it weren't for your sensitivities, if it weren't for your moral uprightness, we men wouldn't be much better than just pigs in a mud puddle. And I'm serious. Somebody described it as being that when God made man, he looked at him and said, I can do better than that. And that may very well be something to that. But the human personal identity, the human personal individual identity is tied up inseparably with your sexual identity. You can't think of yourself as a person without thinking yourself as a male person or as a female person. You may not even recognize all of the implications of such identification that you do subconsciously and consciously, but you cannot really think of yourself without thinking of yourself as a male or female. Now, you destroy that difference between male and female, or blur that difference to any degree, and to that degree that you blur it or erase it, to that degree you bring about real troubles and you destroy the personal identity of the individual. I went through this with my sons, this thing of, being a man. And I want my boys to be boys, and I want my girls to be girls. And I'd made a rule at the house that there'd be no high-heeled shoes on my boys, not as long as they were in our home. They wouldn't wear high-heeled shoes. Now, you know, it got fashionable where men were wearing high-heeled shoes. It looked like women were running around. And I don't know what the point was. There have been more sprained ankles in the last 5 years, they say, than at any other time. The incidence of it rose so tremendous that they decided it must be the high-heeled shoes that the men are wearing. Well, I made that rule at our house, no high-heeled shoes on the boys. And don't you know, Lillian, bless her heart, and Tim, my oldest boy, went out shopping one day for a pair of shoes, and here they came home, and there they were, high-heeled shoes. She didn't recognize it, but there they were, about that high. And she said, honey, I didn't even think about it. I didn't recognize it. I said, well, we'll have to take them back. And Tim, of course, you know, he didn't see it at all, and So we took them back and couldn't trade them in because they didn't have anything. So I just went out to the shed and took the hacksaw. And I sawed about that much off of the heel of the shoe. Both of them did a tremendously good job. Took it down to the shoe man and had him put a leather cap on it. And it was a tremendous fine pair of shoes. Tim never wore them, but they were good. And I didn't really care. I didn't really care about the money that the shoes cost. But I wanted him to know whether he was Arthur or Martha. And I didn't want him to be... I wanted him to know that, not have to guess. I didn't want to have him wonder about who he was. Now, and all of this is involved in simply the personal identity of a person, the rise of homosexuality, and their clamor for social acceptance is one of the phenomena of our day. And you may say, well, what has all this got to do with the subject of male and female roles? Well, I think it may be fairly obvious, but let me mention there's a psychiatrist or a psychologist named Ted R. Evans. And in this article here on Who Am I, it's the title of it, it says that Evans cites research that, in his opinion, shows that there is no evidence whatever of any genetic or hormonal causes for homosexuality. Homosexuality, he says, is a socially learned process that can develop in a boy when the mother is frustrated and allies with the son against the father, or when the mother wanted a daughter, etc., etc., and he lists another cause or two. But these are some of the causes that this man cites for homosexuality. But it all boils down to the simple fact that the male and female identity is best transmitted and reinforced through the examples that parents and older people set for the younger people. Now, you were made a man or you were made a woman. But if you do not see in those who go before you the necessary male and female roles, then you become confused as to what your role is, and you become confused then as to what your identity is. And consequently, you may have an aversion to one, you may have an aversion to the males if you're a male, or an aversion to the females if you're a female. And it works in such odd ways, it may produce a quirk or a twist in your personality to where you don't really know who you are. But let's, tonight, I want to notice with you a few thoughts. First of all, let's look at the female role. May I say that your role in society is so very, very important. You're not second rate at all. The day that you have to become equal with a man, you'll have to step down to do it. No woman will ever have to step up to become equal with a man. She'll have to step down to do it. You're the queen of the home. The hand that rocks the cradle genuinely rules the world. Not generally. The hand that rocks the cradle genuinely rules the world. You can mark it down. Behind every good man, there is a good woman, either his wife or his mother or his grandmother or some female who has made that man and has gone a long way to making him what he is. You're the queen of the home. You have a place and a position in society that nobody else has. Listen, let me read some of these things that are so, I believe, interesting and important. Listen to this one. This was written by a little 8-year-old boy. And you'll get an idea about how important a mama is. Mother makes good food. She plays with me and my brother. She cooks good. She always kisses me goodnight. She always understands me. She cooks good. Swell person. Never complains. She plays baseball with me sometimes and sometimes does dishes for me. She doesn't spank as hard as Dad. Cooks good. She lets me do things and go places than Dad does. And this is read just like he wrote it, misspelling and all. She loves me and understands me. Doesn't tan me if Salamander gets out. Takes me aside in an argument. She sews good, S-O-W-S. She sews good. She loves me and cooks good, everything. She's very sweet and kind, I guess he meant. My mother always has money to lend me and most of the time doesn't expect to get it back. She cleans my clothes. She takes care of me when I'm sick and she's gorgeous. She cooks good. I love her and nobody can stop me. Now, that'll give you an idea. Here's another one that'll give you a further idea. It's entitled, Where's Mother? Our little one lay mid snow-white sheets and smiled in peaceful slumber sweet. Soon he opened his blue eyes wide and he saw me standing at his side. His baby lips quivered. Loud he cried, Where's Mother? Small Anne was playing in the yard. She ran too fast and fell so hard. Up the steps she ran past me with bleeding hands and aching knee. Tears in her eyes she could not see. She cried, Where's Mother? When Jack comes in each day from school, throws his coat and cap on the stool, into the kitchen he quickly flies, thinking of cookies and apple pies. If she's not there, he always cries, Where's Mother? My lovely daughter came up the steps, and right by my chair she wept. She asked not for sister or brother, but she asked the same old question over, Where's Mother? I was their dad, and I could not see why they asked for mother instead of me. But the next day when I came from town, before I laid my burden down, I asked the children standing round, Where's Mother? There just simply is no place there's no one that can fill your place but you. And the instruction in Titus, the second chapter, is so valuable. Bid the older women likewise to be reverent in demeanor or behavior, not to be slanderous. And I'm going to wait till you turn there because there's something that needs to be said about this. In Titus 2, verse 3, there's a principle involved. Bid the older women likewise to be reverent in behavior, not to be slanderers or slaves to drink. They're to teach what is good and so train the young women to love their husbands and children, to be sensible, chaste, domestic, kind, and submissive to their husbands. that the Word of God may not be discredited. You see, one principle involved here is that the older women are to train the younger women in this role of the woman. And we're failing in this today. We're not training our young women to be domestic. That word is translated keepers of home or keepers at home or keepers of the home. That's what the word means. It means one who takes care of the domain of the home. And we're not training that. That's been discarded. That particular aspect is being neglected. Mothers are not training their daughters to become mothers and wives. They're training them to do everything else, but we're not passing this sense of identity down from one generation to the next, and we're failing in that, and until we can recover it, we're going to be reaping the consequences, I'm convinced, for years to come. Domestic or keepers of home, this is one of the most important ones, and yet it's one of the ones that we're eliminating and discarding. Let me show you how that's happening, and I want to read two or three other things. She replied, "A home? Why do I need a home? I was born in a hospital, educated in a college, courted in an automobile, and married in a church. I get my food at restaurants, delicatessens. I spend my mornings at golf, my afternoons at bridge, and my evenings dancing or at the movies. And when I die, I'll be buried from an undertaker's. All I need is a garage." And a two-car garage at that, because usually he goes his way and she goes hers. I say usually. Too often that's the case. We're living under the two-car curse. At one time, if the family went anywhere, they went together. One man was trying to hold his marriage together. Recently, he said, "We're trying to hold our marriage together. We're going on separate vacations." Not the same vacations, separate vacations. And I know it's good to get away from each other occasionally. You'll appreciate each other more when you come back. But listen to this. A Census Bureau report Wednesday. This was the Arkansas Gazette, June the 25th of June of 1975. A Census Bureau report said the smaller, more fragmented, and less stable family has signaled a basic change in how Americans live and how they relate to each other. Paul C. Glick, senior demographer in the Census Bureau's population division and author of the report, said, "I think this is something of a new complex syndrome of circumstances we've never had before." His report noted, for one thing, a change in the role of women. He cites the great number of women working, the higher educational attainments of women, their increased economic independence from husbands, and a sudden shortage of eligible marriage partners for women. Now, there are enough particular facets in that report that we could spend our time talking about each one of them, maybe each night. But the one that I'm referring to here that I believe more greatly affects and more acutely affects our relationships in the home is that of the mother working. You know, a woman only has 24 hours a day, just like a man. She cannot be a worker at an 8-hour-a-day job and a wife to a husband and satisfy his needs and a mother to children and satisfy their needs and a housekeeper and all of the varied things that require her services. You just can't do all of those things at once. You can't do all of them just being one person. You'll never be able to do all of these and do them successfully. But our age is demanding almost that women get out and work. I don't believe it's necessary. I was talking to a lady today and her husband, and she wondered if she was training her children right by teaching them that a wife should be a homemaker and a mother and a wife. She said, "I'm wondering if I'm training them right, or am I training them to where they're going to be obsolete? They're not going to be able to cope with the society in which they're growing up." I said, "Don't you ever doubt for one moment. Yes, you're training her right. You train her to live within the income of her husband. Train her to be a homemaker. Train her to be a wife. And I guarantee you it will eliminate many frustrations, and you'll have inherited, by God's own design, the most honorable position that any woman can occupy in the entire world. There is no role that is more honorable than the role of a wife and mother. That's what God created you for. And it's for the preservation of society that He placed you as a wife and as a mother in that pivotal position. You're not accepting a second-rate job. You're not accepting something that has no honor or no importance attached to it. You are, when you accept the role of a wife and the role of a mother, you're accepting that pivotal position in the process of the preservation of society that nobody but a mother can provide. And don't you ever forget it. Listen, though, what's happening. In an article in 1968 entitled Sweden's War on the Family, in 1968, the Swedish government issued a report called The Status of Women in Sweden. Stockholm's Socialist Daily headlined its story, Women, Don't Let a Man Support You. That was in September the 28th, 1968, and that was nearly 10 years ago. And it commented favorably, the government is making an assault on marriage. The place of women or woman is in the labor market, not in the home. Now, does that sound like something that we're hearing in America? We're 10 years behind them, but aren't we hearing that very thing? Haven't you been sold that bill of goods? You have. Now, I realize that I'm talking to a lot of ladies that work. And I realize that it's not very popular to talk about it. And I realize that a lot of people are talking about it, that it's the quality of time you spend with your children, not the quantity. Rubbish. That's true in a sense. But a woman who has worked 8 hours a day and comes home to spend some of that quality time with her children, there ain't much quality left in a woman who's worked hard 8 hours a day and who's getting ready for a demanding husband to come home and find supper fixed and her dressed, you know, like fit to kill for his affections and all. There just isn't much time left for quality time or any other kind of time. Now listen, those of you women who are working, you know this better than I do and better than anybody here in this auditorium. You know what I'm saying is true. I don't have to argue the case with you, but you've been caught in a social phenomenon that has carried you along and you've been sold a bill of goods that there ain't no way out. But that just isn't true. It'll take some upheaval economically, perhaps, but I ask you to do something. If you will put your salary down on one side of the page and then put down how much it costs to babysit the babies and how much it costs for clothes to dress in a way that's compatible with your job, and then how much it costs for perhaps an extra car or the carpool and for eating out, I guarantee you, you add all of those up, and you're working for peanuts. You're not making all that much. That's right. And you know who's paying for it? You know who's paying the bill for mothers working when their little children are at home? The children are paying for it. They are the ones that are paying the price. If they weren't the ones paying the price, we could perhaps stand the strain. But it's our children that are paying the price for women failing to honor the role that God cast them in. Let me read something to you. Dear Brother Woodruff, and this woman wrote me this letter and gave me the permission to use it. Dear Brother Woodruff, I told you I was the product of a working mother. What I wanted you to know was how my mother suffered guilt the last 7 or 8 years of her life. She probably suffered while working too, but was too busy to think much about it. She retired in 1963 and spent the rest of her life worrying whether or not we loved her and apologizing for having neglected us. I never went to visit her, but what she told me, how much she loved me and how much I meant to her and how she wished she could recall the years and tell me every day that she loved me. I heard her many times tell her roommates in the hospital that a woman should never leave her little children unless it was necessary, and that she believed it was impossible for a woman to work and be a wife, a housekeeper, and a mother at the same time. She wasn't a Christian, not even religious, but she realized what a mistake she had made. My mother never knew, as far as I know, how much I resented her working. I resented it even more after I married and had children of my own and would go home to visit. It wasn't until after I became a Christian at the age of 28 that I began to overcome the feeling I had toward my mother. It wasn't that I didn't have a good sitter either, for she was a kind lady and real good to us. But anyway, she goes on and says, your statement was so true that a child doesn't care why or where mother is working. They just know that mother is gone. When mothers tell me that their children are happy when they're working, I always ask them, how do you know? I'm sure my mother thought we were happy too. Children don't always express their true feelings, especially in the presence of their mother. A lot of working mothers have no way of knowing what kind of treatment their child is getting with so-called good babysitters. I know of many cases of children being mistreated by people who were nice, well-respected people in the community. I've been keeping a little girl now for 7 years who was being kept at home with her older brother by a lady who was a nice person and who had kept children for several families. A neighbor called the mother one day and told her the little girl, 3 years old at the time,
was out in the cold without a coat and had come to her house asking for something to eat. The mother dropped in unexpectedly, and the door was locked, and the sitter was watching soap operas. The five-year-old brother was crying and had been slapped for wanting to watch another program. And listen, she goes on and documents more of the cases than those. But you say, but that's unusual. Well, perhaps. But I'll tell you what, it's going to inundate us. We're not going to get off scot-free. We're raising a whole society of children who have been babysat by a TV set and who have been babysat by someone other than their mother and other than their father and who've been cared for them and who have not been shown the male and female role. They haven't been given that idea. And consequently, they're growing up in a society and they don't know who they are. And you watch and mark my word, I'm no prophet, but I'm just simply serving notice on myself and on others. I know this to be a fact. We're going to reap the consequences of the mother failing to be in the home and being the homemaker. We're going to reap the consequences of that. Well, let me make some observations now about the male role. The female role, we'll talk more about it tomorrow morning and tomorrow night, but tomorrow morning at the Bible hour and tomorrow morning at the worship hour. But for tonight, let me pass now to the male role. It's doubly important because only when the male fulfills his role does he free the woman to fulfill her all-important role. Unless the man accepts his responsibility as a man, the woman will have to step in, and from the sheer force of necessity, she'll have to step in and start providing part of what he ought to be doing. And as a result, it will take away from what she ought to be doing because she cannot do it all. She may be capable, but she cannot do it all. Now, the male role is basically twofold, and I want you to turn in your Bibles to the book of Ephesians, and let's look for just a moment, and I want you to see two things about the male role. In verses 25 through 33 of chapter 5 of Ephesians, let's read it, and then I want to point out these two special aspects of his role. Verse 25 says, "Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, that he might present the church to himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. Even so, husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself, for no man ever hates his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it as Christ does the church, because we're members of his body. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to the wife, and the two shall become one. This is a great mystery, and I take it to mean Christ and the church. Nevertheless, let each one of you love his wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband." There are two particular roles here that man must fill. Number one, man is to be the initiator. That's your role as a man. You're to be the initiator. The wife is the reciprocator. That's the way she was made. That's the way that you were made. You were made as an initiator if you're a man. You were made as a reciprocator if you are the woman. And such gracious reciprocators women are. In fact, they're such gracious reciprocators, they can almost make a non-initiating man think he's initiating. That's right. They can let you chase them until you catch him. And that's the way many women do. It's a very subtle way God made you like that. He made you to where you are a reciprocator. He made the man to be the initiator. Notice all the initiating verbs in these few verses here, 25 through 33. Listen, I'm just going to notice the verbs. Love your wives. Christ gave himself up for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her. Present the church to himself. Love your wives in verse 28. Love your wives. Verse 29, nourishes and cherishes it as Christ does the church. Leave your father and mother. Be joined to your wife. Love your wife as you love yourself. See all those initiating verbs? Now, not any of that is said about the wife. Do you know what it says about the wife here? She's to be submissive to her husband. She's to be in subjection to her husband. Does that kind of get to you, that to be in subjection to a man? It does to a lot of women. But listen, there's nothing but sweet music that will come from a woman who is in subjection to a man that's described like this man Men, this is your role. What could be better? What, you've got it made, ladies. If your husband will simply submit himself to Jesus Christ, in fact, he's to be submissive to you too. Verse 21 says, be subject to one another out of respect for Christ. Did you men know that you're supposed to be subject to your wife? That's right. You're supposed to be subject to her. Well, I never heard of that before. I know it. You're supposed to be subject to your wife. Well, how in the world can I be subject? Subject to her needs? Subject to her times when she doesn't feel good? Subject to her emotional requirements? Subject to her whatever it may be? We're going to talk about that more tomorrow morning. But you're to be subject to your wife. This thing of you're being going away scot-free, you know, and leaving her holding the bag is a lot of bull. It's a lot of hogwash. No, sir. That's not Christianity. And the only thing you can call it is sheer irresponsibility. Husbands are to be subject to their wives. But these are the two main aspects in which they're subject. They are to be the initiators. You're to get things started. That's your job as a man. In courtship, if you don't initiate, you know what happens? You frustrate. If a man doesn't initiate, he frustrates. And believe you me, on the campus at Harding College, there are a lot of frustrated women. Simply because of the fact that we've got a whole generation of young men that don't know how to initiate. They come to me wanting some kind of a formula. You wouldn't believe it. You wouldn't believe it. They come to me having no experience whatsoever. Many of them have never had a father that they saw kiss their mother. Some children come to me at that college and say, I have never seen my father kiss my mother. Never. Well, what's the matter? The matter lies simply in the fact that we've lost who we are. You make sure that your son sees you take a hold of your wife and love her and kiss her. And you make sure, ladies, that you let your daughters see you respond graciously to your husband's embrace. They learn how to make love through watching their mom and daddy make love. And they learn tenderness, and they learn affection, and they learn either how to initiate as a man or how to reciprocate as a woman. They learn that. And if you deprive them of it, you're providing them with some real serious faults and character flaws as they grow up to be mature people. They're going to have a harder time. If you don't initiate, you're frustrated, both in courtship and in marriage. Listen to this that was written by a girl on the college campus. Men, it's entitled, and you have to say it like this. Men, there's no other way to read that title but while raising your lip. Men, if you smile at him, he thinks you're flirting. If you don't, he thinks you're an iceberg. If you let him kiss you, he wishes you were more reserved. If you don't, he'll seek consolation elsewhere. If you flatter him, he thinks you're simple. If you don't, he thinks you don't appreciate him. If you talk of love and romance, he thinks you're asking him to marry you. If you're a good girl, he wonders why you aren't human. If you return his caresses, he thinks you're cheap. If you don't, he'll find a girl that will. If you go out with other guys, he'll think you're fickle. If you don't, he thinks no one else will have you. Men, God bless them, they don't know what they want. Now, that's not poetry. That's sheer frustration. That's right. I'll tell you, we're going to have to become the kind of men that we ought to be if our homes are going to be the kind of homes they ought to be. I do not blame the women for the problems that confront our homes today. The blame lies upon us men. And brethren, I'm confident that you're no different from me. When my family is in trouble, it's my fault, not my wife's. I'm the head of that home, and that means more than just serving as a Hitler-type despot. That's not what it's talking about. To be the head of the home means that you're responsible for the smooth running of that machine, and that God will hold you and me as men responsible. And you're to initiate, as we said last night, in these four areas that we named the four C's, in consideration, in communication, in Christ-centeredness, and in cupidity, the affection and the initial initiating of affection and concern and care. This is our responsibility. When communication breaks down, it's your responsibility to restore it. When there's need for consideration, you're to be the one who initiates it and sees that it doesn't go lacking. When there's need for whatever kind of consideration for the other person's feelings, you're to be the one who gives yourself up for your wife. That's the kind of love that Paul says Jesus had for the church. He gave himself up for her. That means he denied himself for her. And I'll tell you what, it's only sheer, rank immaturity that causes men to pout and sulk when they have been asked to give their wife consideration when she doesn't feel good or when she needs some reinforcement and all of this. It's just sheer, rank immaturity, man. There's no other explanation for it. And I've done my share of sulking. Man, I've laid over inside my side of the bed, you know, and I thought, you know, what all do you think? And I've pouted. Well, it's immaturity. It's immaturity. And you'll never have a meaningful marriage until you learn how to grow up as a man. Never will. When the time comes that you'll do like he says here, that you will give yourself up for her. Listen, husbands, love your wives like Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her that he might sanctify her. Now, there are two things here that this provides, but let me just say this is enough as far as you being the initiator. You're to be the one that starts it. You're to be the one that keeps it going. And you know, if you're not the one that's much of an initiator, sometimes by personality you're maybe a bit more withdrawn, then it's going to mean that you're going to have to get outside of yourself and take upon yourself part of a personality perhaps that does not necessarily very comfortably fit you. But somebody said all it takes to initiate affection is just five fingers. I love you very much. And every time you go by, just throw up those five fingers. Just, you know. And she'll get the message. If you don't say I love you very often and you can't find yourself being able to say it, just tell her one day, and if you have to stumble and stammer, that's all right. Say, honey, I don't say this very well, and it's not easy for me to tell you I love you, but look at this. I love you very much, and when I do that to you, that's what I mean. Okay? Then you have initiated, and boy, she'll appreciate it. And don't make her stand around wondering whether or not she's loved and cared for, because this says that a man nourishes and he cherishes her. That's the way Christ did the church. He loved it and gave himself up for it. And no more this foolish thought that, as one man said, about continuing the courtship after marriage, you know. You ought to keep courting your wife after you get married. One man, though, said, oh, well, you don't keep chasing the bus after you've caught it. Oh, boy. Somebody needs to kick him around the block. That's ridiculous. No, you keep courting her. Keep making her know that she's the queen of your life. There's nothing that's more important to a woman. And the older she gets, the more she needs it. And when she approaches about 35 or 40, you've got to serve as this reinforcement because she goes through trials and tribulations that you can't understand as a man. Be sensitive toward her. We'll talk more about that in the morning. Well, in courtship and marriage, both of these, you must be the initiator. But then the second role that he mentions here is that man is the protector and woman is the protected. That's one of the most important relationships that a man has. That's one of the most important functions that he performs. He's to be the initiator, yes, but he's to be the protector of the woman. Now look, that one simple action or one simple fulfillment is one of the most important things in the sense that it is the greatest safeguard for purity. If you'll serve, and you young men that are not married yet, let me tell you something. If you'll look upon yourselves as the protector of that woman that you're dating, look upon yourself as her protector, and I guarantee you, you won't have near the trouble keeping yourself pure with her. I know. I've been that road myself, and I have assumed that position that I'm going to be your protector. Now, there are going to be times, and the times are pretty well often, when you're going to have to protect her from you. That's right. But there are going to be other times when you're going to have to protect her from herself. Because there are going to be times when she'll also come nearer responding to your advances that are improper than she will at some other time. Now, you know what I'm talking about. Once when I was about 17 years old, I was dating this little girl. She wasn't a Christian, but she was a very nice girl, and I was dating her and had dated her about a year. And one night we came in from a date, and we pulled her father's car up into the garage, and we're getting ready to get out. And she let me know, in no uncertain terms, that she was mine just for the asking. And man, I mean in terms that I knew full well what she meant. And she knew that I knew. And I knew that she knew that I knew. And she knew that I knew that she knew I knew. That was it. She said it in no uncertain terms by her actions. And then God gave me something in that hour that I didn't possess normally. I wasn't very noble as a young man. But I told that young lady, I said, no, I won't take advantage of you. I said, I love you too much for that. And I said, you save yourself to the man or for the man that you're going to marry. And I know good and well in her eyesight I must have grown 3 feet in that moment. But I served as her protector. It's the greatest thing that you can do toward guaranteeing purity in your own life and in the relationship that you have with some girl. You tried. Look upon yourself as her protector. All right, but something else. Not only is it the greatest assurance of protection or for purity, it's also the greatest provider of security. Now listen, let me give you just a verse on this about being the way it guards your life in purity. In verse 26, it's still in Ephesians 5, it says here, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, that he might, now watch what the result of giving yourself up for her is, that he might sanctify her or make her special, that he might make her holy, that he might set her apart as something real, genuinely special. That's what the word sanctify means. Having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, that he might present the church to himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing. And if you were to translate that into the relationship that a man has with a young lady before they get married, you watch how it translates. Here they are now courting each other. And he says, you men, give yourselves up for your dates. Give yourselves up for your fiancé. So that you might set her apart as something special. Having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, that you might present your bride to yourself in splendor. And as she walks down the aisle in that white dress and that veil, that's the most beautiful sight on earth. But he says, you've got to make sure that the relationship is such that she's without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she should be holy and without any smudges, without any whatever. He says that's the greatest security as far as purity is concerned. Then he picks up and talks about how for security reasons. Listen, in verse 28, even so husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. Security. Look, he who loves his wife loves himself. When you put your wife down, men, you're putting yourself down. Either in front of her, if you make her feel worthless, you're lowering yourself. That's all you're doing. And out in public, if you speak to her in such a way that you undercut her and you're putting her down always and making her look like a goon, oh, you're just making yourself look like that. Because a man is doing to himself what he does to his wife. He says here that you ought to love your wife. The pictures of two men. This letter came from an unsigned letter. At the top she says, you have my permission to use this letter in counseling or sermons if you think it can help others. Dear Brother Woodruff, I'm writing because I feel desperate. I'm scared. My marriage needs help, and I don't know where to turn. Before marriage, my husband was so thoughtful. The first few months of our marriage, he was constantly leaving notes or doing little things that said, you're special. This was one reason I married him. He knew the little things he did made me feel loved. Right now, my house is a mess. Sex is a chore. And I'm irritable with my children. On recent anniversaries, he has said, I had too much to do to bother with getting you something.
I knew money was too scarce to buy something, but a card can be bought for 25 cents. A note would have cost even less. My birthdays are ignored. It isn't that I want things, I want him and his attention. It boils down to the fact that he feels, so he says, that since we're married, little things are unnecessary. After all, he makes the living, and we have what we need, but I'm starving emotionally. I've tried talking. He knows little things meant so much to me. I'm ignored. Oh, he says, I know that right now he feels he does not get enough sex. But when I'm ignored all day, it is hard to be responsive at night. I don't like to feel like a maid and mistress. Listen, men, she's getting down to the nitty-gritty. I want to be a sweetheart and a wife. And if he'd just be more thoughtful, he'd have as much sex as he could handle, for my sex drive is as high as his. I love him too much ever to leave him, but I wonder at times if I'll do like others and just build my life around my children. Please, please, and she underlines these two words. Please, please, in these sermons you're preaching, try to get across the importance of courting after marriage. An unexpected note means so much. A single flower occasionally means more than a large bouquet every once or in 3 years. I need his attention so much because I love him more than anyone in the world. Now, I submit that as exhibit A of a frustrated woman, but she's not unusual. There are a lot of frustrated women. But you see, this man had forgotten to serve as the initiator. Once he'd caught the buzz, he quit running, and that's what the result is. He had failed to serve as her protector because she was starving emotionally. But he wouldn't, you know. Huh, get up. What's the matter with you anyway? And there she stands with a dish towel in her hands, crying her heart out. And there he stands, hitting himself over the head with a hammer because he's not in his right mind, because his wife is hurting and he doesn't have enough sense to see it. And he takes this big, bold front, you know, and goes about his blustering business and as though nothing were wrong. You spell the name C-L-O-D, Claude. That's the way you spell that man's name. Here's another picture. This was written August the 8th, 1963, by a man who, when he died, was 91 years old. He was one of the elders of the church in Searcy. Brother J.A. Thompson. He wrote this when his wife was 76 years old. And he was about 80, let's see, in 63, and he died in 70, about 74. He was about, about 85 years old. Listen to this. My beloved wife. I'm not sure I can read it, but you bear with me. 76 years ago today, a baby girl was born in Ozark County, Missouri, who after 21 years on April the 3rd, 1910, became my helpmeet and took upon herself my name. And for 55 years, we have loved and trusted each other until we have come to be like each other. Soon after we were married, we took upon ourselves the name of Christ and trusted in him who said, I will never fail you, I will never forsake you. And he certainly has kept his promise. God in his providence has blessed us in so many ways that we can never thank him enough. God has blessed us with health and strength well beyond 70. Praise him evermore. You can never know how much you have helped me to live the Christian life. Hand in hand with greater love, we are nearing the end of the journey. Signed, a devoted husband. Now, which of those men do you want to be? The choice is yours. Which of those wives would you like to be? Oh. Now, look. These two letters represent the difference. There it is. This is the difference that Jesus Christ makes in a life. Though this man may think he's a Christian. We're going to talk about that tomorrow. You'll have to make that decision, man, yourself, as to which of these two men you want to be. I saw Brother Thompson when he was 91 years old. You know where he was? He's up on the roof of his house. And he had carried a huge roll of tar paper up the ladder. 91 years old. Miss Birdie is his wife. You know why he was up there with that tar paper and a hammer and nails? Well, there was a leak in the roof, and he'd gone up there to protect Miss Birdie from getting wet. 91. And I'll never forget that scene as long as I live. He was her protector. He was her initiator. That's the male role. And the female role is to be the reciprocator, to be the mother, to be the wife, to be the protected one. And then together, like he says here, you'll become like each other. And then nearer and nearer as you get toward the end of life, with having loved each other, that's what it's all about. And God bless us. Let's be serious about our marriages. We've got something on our hands that can absolutely be the most wonderful thing on earth, or it can be a living hell. And it's mostly up to the man. May God bless us. Holy Father, we come tonight having made so many mistakes. We're not mature. Would you help us, Lord, as we look at ourselves, would you help us to resolve tonight that we're going to be better men, better women? Would you give us, please, the honesty of really looking at ourselves? Help us as we've looked into this mirror tonight to check and see whether or not we're fulfilling our role as a man and as a woman. And will you bless our homes? Bless these men and women that are here tonight. I thank you for them, Lord. Were they not interested in making their marriages better, they wouldn't be here. And were they not in respect and honor of you, they wouldn't be here. And thank you for them. Now grant us tonight, as we go home and respond to this message, grant us the openness toward one another to do whatever is necessary to reaffirm our love for each other. And grant us to grow more like Jesus each day that we live. And bless our homes, Lord, in Jesus' name. Amen.